215-501-6880.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-9 938-4643.
Sharon Jones and the Dap Kinks. Absolutely the, just in recent years, the one of the great additions to anybody's Christmas music catalog. And knowing how sick she was when they taped that, unbelievable. It's funny the case that you pulled that up, because I listened to it this morning and watched the video. I actually listened to like a third of the, you must have listened to four cuts actually from it. And if for those of you that follow on Twitter, Rich Migliori's with us in the background. Speaking of holidays, I conflated the holiday season with Dick Van Dyke's 96th birthday yesterday, and I happened to come across, while I was listening to some of those cuts, came across something I hadn't seen in forever, which was Andy Kaufman interrupting Dick in a 1976 Christmas special that is so funny. It's so great. pull up my feed later, Rich, and watch. It's about an 8-minute clip where Dick's doing this, supposedly a Christmas in Coronado. He's singing, and Andy comes out and interrupts him and launches into Elvis, and it is so funny.
And so he was a world class bee breaker.
It's funny, and underneath the, you know, sometimes especially because this was like an 8-minute clip, I was reading through the comments underneath, and somebody mentioned that they had seen Andy Kaufman at my father's Mustache, which I don't know if you remember. I don't even know if it's still there. It might be, but my aunt Florence lived in Roslyn, and my father's Mustache was a bar, was something else. My Father's Place, I think, is right.
Yeah.
And
I actually saw Steve Forbert there. Me and Carmelo went and saw Steve Forbert there, who I think was one of those, singer-songwriters that could have went big, but like didn't really want all the accoutrements of, the fame and everything, but he had some classic songs. You're familiar with Romeo's Tune?
I know of Forbert. I'm sure if I'd pulled it up, but there'd be things that I'd heard before.
Yeah, that's like my favorite, Romeo's Tune. That's like a really, that's a cool love song.
Billy Joel, who was from right there. He played there too, and if I'm not mistaken, the Piano Man story is based on his time, playing at my father's place. That has always been the, and all the point was that the guy had talked about seeing Andy Kaufman before he was a national act doing his bit at my father's place.
Could you imagine seeing him before, like, you knew what it was? Like, I'm sure he confused a lot of people, you know.
Oh, no doubt. Right?
Yeah. It's so funny. Meanwhile, this is perfect timing because I just got done working out. It's called the barn workout, mucking stalls and throwing down hay. And now if I could figure out a way to market this, like, to people, and then they can come work for me and actually pay me.
Now this is your lot now, as a gentleman farmer. That's what you got to do now. This is part
of
your
legacy. Well, you know what? Actually, it's good because I really don't like to work out. Like, it's boring to me. So you're actually getting a workout in, and you're accomplishing stuff, and you're not thinking about it. So it actually works out well, and I like being outside with the dogs. Although Lila and Jack disappeared through the backfield in the woods, and they haven't been back in a while, and that means they probably found some sort of a dead critter, and I'm going to have to go out there and get them away from it.
At least you don't have to deal with what we've got here when it comes to them dragging the cats here. They drag them to the porch. Specifically, the kitten. The kitten. I don't know how to stop the kitten. The kitten is literally.
But you're the one that gets squirrels, right? I mean, I was there.
Oh, he's just it's. Luckily, things have slowed a little bit, since it got cold. He seems like he's less aggressive. He's not out there as much. But my God, it was like Summer of Sam here. To be honest,
oh, God,
there were headlines in the Times Union. Squirrel disappearance is mounting.
That's so funny. Oh my God.
He's bad. Well, Richie, I didn't see you on Sunday when we came down. It's funny, it's so difficult to get races to go sometimes. And, then lo and behold, there's two races in the book. One that Kid Chocolate was eligible for, and one that Shazando targeted, and both races go, and they end up with two starts on the same card.
Yeah, I was up on the set, and I've had a thought about it. I probably could have snuck down for a minute just to say hi. I was, we were up there on the third floor. You know what? The little corner of the Equestrian now, they turned into a set, and which is great because, we were actually on an outdoor set for a little while, not this year, but previously. And it gets really cold. I mean, up even at Belmont, before we come to Aqueduct.
It's always cold. Always at Belmont.
Yeah, that wind blows through there, and it's just uncomfortable. They built us a nice little set off the trustees room now, which is kind of cool because the owner's boxes are, the glass behind us, and you kind of have that little activity going on behind you. And then now Aqueduct with the Equestris. And what they've been doing, too, at night, like when we're leaving, because it's dark when we leave, the infield board will be lit up with, like, this fireplace, like, this huge matrix board. And it's actually cozy looking. It's kind of cool. I like it. What I don't like is driving home in the dark because I just been struggling mightily with that, and actually slid off the road on Dover Furnace Road a few weeks ago because I just can't see very well, and so I've been actually just staying down more often. I just can't do it. You know, it's become actually a little dangerous. I mean, my left eye, I've lost so much of my peripheral vision anyway. Eesh. And they think that's all like post-concussion stuff. And then in the dark, you know, with only really the one good eye, it's like, I can't tell what I'm doing.
Oof, that's not good. The Tina's got that concern with me, with my rebuilt left eye. Plus I saw the other day you managed to catch a fleeting image of another bear walking across the street, across the road.
Yeah, that was like a month ago that he, me and Carmella had gone into town. We're like 10, almost 11 miles from like a Stop and Shop, right? But in our town in Millbrook, there's a really cool little independent grocery store, Morona's Market, and it's got a great butcher market in there and everything. And it's a lot of, you know, local product, and we like that. We support that. And so we were like, yeah, what should we make for dinner? Right, let's go into Morona's. And it was like just at dusk when we were coming back, and we're 7 miles from town. And he just, here he comes, just kind of meandering across the road, stopped, gave us a look. Then he went into the woods, and I could tell the way he was going. We were about a quarter of a mile from where you turn onto our dirt road, and he was heading in the direction. So I said, he's going to be going right through the back of our property. So I got back to the house, and I went out there, and I just was, you know, I wanted to get a good look at him, maybe get a good video or something. And I went all the way to my back paddocks, and I hear something crunching through the woods. But, you know, not that I could see. It was in the woods, Steve. So I crunch, yeah. Crunch, crunch, crunch. And it stopped. And I said, well, it could be a deer. Even though, like, the timing was just right for what I was thinking where he was headed. So I just tossed a rock, like, in that direction. And it got completely still. A deer would have ran off, you know. And I went, oh, that's got to be him. And I was like, well, all right. What's smart here? I mean, maybe I should back away a little bit.
Let me, yeah.
You know, I wasn't going into the woods, but, you know, it's just, you know, three plank fencing, like, you know, horse paddock fencing. It's not like it's like a big chain link fence going to keep him out or something. So then I heard him kind of crunch on his way, and I was like, I never got any kind of video. But, you know, we've had a lot of that kind of activity. Then we had a couple of wild dogs come through here the one day in the morning. My dogs were going absolutely bonkers. And then they were like, you know, going around my chicken coop, even though everything's closed up. And then, because the way my barn's set up, Steve, we have the stalls, and then they have like a little outdoor area. I call it their patio. So like they can be in their stall when the weather's good. I leave it open. They can come out, and they have like,
sure,
you know, maybe, you know, this little corral. And then one of the dogs is over there like sniffing around like he's going to try to get in the corral. And that's when I ran out there like, all right, you know, enough of this. And then they ran off. Like, I have a shovel in the garage. I grabbed the shovel. I was like, this could go south quick too, but I can't have them near my horses. So and then they ran off. So
courtesy of the internet, there is so much video evidence of, you know, the encountering now of nature with you know, with the public, and plus, of course, encroachment on their, you know, on their habitat doesn't, you know, that's yeah. No, that's not a pleasant story, but it is amazing how often we're seeing. I've seen the Christmas. I think it was in California. The bears, the two bears, attacking one of those blow up. One of those blow up reindeer on somebody's lawn. It's hysterical.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Oh, it's great.
That there was one a couple months ago where the bear had some cubs and was up on the fence and was the dogs.
Yeah, that's great.
Lady's dogs.
And she runs out. Yeah, she runs out and she pushes the bear on the bear off the fence. It's hysterical.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
I mean,
crazy.
You see what we do for our animals? We're like, you know, it's like your kids. I mean, it's,
the
you know,
best.
It's funny. I was thinking about this last night because yesterday was National Day of the Horse. And,
yes.
And you know, Carmella sometimes says, you know, we've had people work for us periodically here, and that I'm too harsh. Like I'm too hard to work for. And you know, like when we had the conversation, and yeah, maybe I'm a little rough around the edges the way I'll present something sometimes, but at the end of the day, think about your horses. Like if someone doesn't do everything properly, it's like putting your child in daycare. You're going to be unforgiving if the kid doesn't get fed properly, if the kid doesn't, you know, like a baby can't get out of a crib and go get water or go to the fridge and get something to eat. It's the same thing with a horse. They can get their stall and feed themselves or go to the water fountain, you know. So, like, I think that's the way you have to be. Like, either make sure you take care of my animals the way you would my children, and we'll have no problem, right? I mean, I don't think that that's that harsh. I mean, maybe the harsh part is that I will, you know, I don't mince words. But there's a right way to do things, right? I mean, I mean, you know me, so maybe you're thinking, yeah, I could hear you going off, but
no, no, absolutely. I mean, we hear the stories from daycare and through Andrea and Zach with Lennon, and I hear you. They had an incident. Like last week or the week before, where they got a baby with COVID, and so it's like, you had to isolate. You know, Lennon had to isolate 10 days, and it's alarming. I hear you.
It's funny too. Like I laughed because I remember when the kids were young and Carmela would kind of be screening, for a babysitter, how she had specific ideas, and it's your kids, compromise. But it's the same thing with your animals. I don't see, a whole lot of difference. Although I'll say this right now, the best babysitter we ever had was Michael Hushin.
he was
sharing a house in Saratoga, and me and Carmela would have to go to like a benefit or a function, and Joey was with Uncle Mike.
I love it. Yeah, that came up. Who'd that come up with the other day about the same topic, and we were laughing about the various babysitters, babysat.
Well, we babysat Norman Cassie.
Yep, that's right. That's come up before, and I always bring up Leslie Young and babysat for Gary and Josephine for Bobby and Gina.
Yeah, when
she was like a teenager.
That's so funny. Now they're all big.
Exactly. The best babysitting story I think I could probably produce is I dated a girl in Cincinnati who I worked with at Proctor, Kathy Evans, and she went to Indiana University, and she used to babysit Bobby Knight's kids.
Oh wow! Oh my God, that's funny.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's a good babysitting story.
And yesterday I couldn't come on because I had to go get Luciano at the airport. He had gone. I actually got up 3 o'clock Friday morning and drove him. And they went. He has this soccer club that the New York team that won the championship.
Yeah.
So they had been in Philadelphia, in Boston when they won the semi or the. Whatever round to go to the semifinals, and then they went to Philadelphia and they won the semifinals, and then the championship was out in Portland, so they all flew out there, like Luch and a bunch of these guys that they traveled to see their team play, and they won the championship, obviously. I was on set, Bobby Cott, our producer, and I just said, hey, give me, updates every now and then, because he's in my ear. And he's like, it's 1-0, and he was giving me reports, still 1-0. And then I didn't get a report for a while, and, you're doing the show, and I wasn't thinking that much about it. And I realized for a while, I said, hey, Bobby, you didn't, like we were in commercial, I said, what's going on? You haven't told me. He goes, they tied the game with 8 seconds left. I didn't want to tell you, maybe throw you off your game. So we finished, and I went downstairs to the office, and we watched the penalty kicks, and they wanted penalty kicks. Then Luciano and his buddies, we're staying at the same hotel as the players. The players came back, And they wound up hanging out with the players all night, and they had the cup, and they were, you know, like, toting it all around Portland, and you know, I guess they had an awfully good time, so I had to go pick him up yesterday. He came in on a red eye.
Nice. Nice. Yeah, it's funny. Driving to Aqueduct on Sunday, Tina and I, you know, you come down. I think Yeah, she brought us in kind of a funny way, and then up. Then we went out the Van Wyck. But everywhere as we were driving down, I and riffing off of the recent, you know, the soccer playoff, it there seems to really be a critical mass in the U.S. The soccer. I think soccer's turned the corner here. In
oh,
terms
absolutely!
Of, right,
it's different now.
Yeah, I really sense that the and there's actually a couple of things that have come. Tina and I were talking about it because as a school system, you know, there's a lot less risk for school systems and a lot less expense, frankly, to run soccer as a fall sport instead of football, and a lot less injury.
Yeah.
And liability and et cetera and head injury. And what do you need? You need a couple of nets and you need you know, a handful of balls, and then that's it.
Yeah,
that's it. And I guess some shin guards for the kids. Other than that, what is there?
Well, you know, honestly, like as a kid, soccer was not popular, you know, when I was growing up in Brooklyn, and I played in Gil Hodges Little League Baseball, and just so thrilled that Gil Hodges is getting inducted in Baseball Hall of Fame, finally, long overdue. And then played in All-American Football in Gerritsen, in the Gerritsen Beach League, and I was a really good defensive back, Steve. I wasn't very big, but I could get under guys, and I could time my hits, and there was a fullback from this other team, and it wasn't like now where they really teach kids how to tackle, and there's still injuries. I mean, it's unavoidable. It's a contact sport, but this kid was a fullback in another team, and he was built like a Johnny plug. He was really short, squat, but really thick, and he would put his head down and run with his head low to the ground and just, like, run through people leading with his head, which, you know, now they would pull him up and say, ooh, you can't run like that, and, you know, but it was just a different time, and I thought that I was small enough that I could get underneath him as low as his head was, so I dropped my head and really genuinely was shocked when we went helmet to helmet. I mean, it was pow, and we were both on our butts seeing stars. And now flash forward, that was like I was like 11 or 12 years old, and I remember being a kid and having a headache and my neck hurt for like a month. And I went down in that horrible spill in 1988. This is, you know, probably 10 years later. And after they did the surgery, I had broken my neck, and they fused everything. The doctor tells me, hey, you know, you had an old fracture in your neck that healed on its own. It had to be from that.
Wow.
But you're a kid. You're much more pliable. You know, you're like, ah, it hurts, you know, so you got a probably hairline fracture. You don't know it. And again, it wasn't like now. Like, I think I was out two plays, and the coach was like, you ready to go back in? I'm like, yeah, you know, I'm seeing stars, but yeah, sure, you know.
How many fingers? How many fingers am I holding up?
I mean, it's crazy. I mean, you think about how things evolve over the years. You know, people would leave the rafters in Saratoga. It was down a dirt road down to the lake.
Yep.
And they shouldn't have been driving. I mean, and
no.
Police might pull someone over to give them a ride home.
Yep. Yep.
I mean, you know, how nuts. Think about, like, how, again, just things evolve, and you realize, like, how stupid were we? Like, what you know, how could you allow these things, you know?
Yeah. No doubt. No, I can't. Only had one. I can only think of one potential incident when I did drink. That's funny you say that. When I said to myself, "Boy, I don't feel great. I don't know if I should be driving." And I pulled over actually, and I thought, hey, "Let me sit." And a cop stopped. I was living in Kansas City, And a cop stopped, and you know, he said, "What's going on?" I said, "I pulled over. I kind of wondered if I should be driving." And he said, "All right, good for you." He said, "Here, give me your keys." I said, "Okay." He said, "Stay here, and I'll check back in a half an hour, 45 minutes." And he came back, and yeah, that's what he did. This is 1980, probably 84. Yeah. I'd say 1984. Yeah. And came back and checked on me. He said, "How you feel?" He said, "I think good. I said, I think I'm ready." He said, "All right, I'll follow you for a little." And he followed me a little bit, and off I went. I went home. That's a true story.
But I remember this distinctly, the same thing, Saratoga. Not me personally, but people I knew, friends of mine, that were driving out of there. And you knew they shouldn't have been driving, probably, you know, but it wasn't as, you know, in the forefront of your mind. And then coming up behind them down the end of the dirt road, and the cop is, you know, saying, "Hey, come on, I'll give you a lift, leave the car, you'll get it in the morning." And like, I couldn't even imagine. I mean, you know, it really is. And the same thing with sports, like, you know, things, you know, we had kids that, you know, and listen, Gil Hodges Little League was a really great Little League. Like, they taught fundamentals. They, you know, we had, like, Lee Mazzilli came out of there. A couple other guys made it to the major leagues. I mean, you know, it was a really good Little League. Gil Hodges would come to the opening day parade. My brother Nicky got, wow. He won, like, the lottery. Like, everybody got a ticket, and he got a signed Gil Hodges baseball, which he still has, you know. But, like, they would have kids, young kids, throwing curveballs and junk. And, you know, like, you knew then, like, they didn't know then that it was ruining a kid's elbow, his arm. And you know, it was just amazing that like, you know, years go by and you go, "Oh, no, you can't have kids throwing that stuff. Their arm isn't formed enough to handle the pressure." You know, it's just remarkable, really.
Yeah, you talk about the concussion. Yeah. Concussion protocol. What day of the week is it? Saturday. You're fine.
You said, "How many kids
you
hold up?"
Yeah, you'd be okay. What's your name?
Yeah, exactly.
That's concussion protocol.
Well, you know, like, I fell one day on a horse of John Veach's at Aqueduct, and I was on a filly in the stake. Mike Keogh was assistant to Atfield, and I wanted to ride this filly in the stake, and I hit the ground. I got knocked out. My horse fell at the 3/8 pole, and by the time they got to me, I was conscious, but the only thing in my mind was I got to, like, shake it off and show them I'm okay because I want to ride the filly in the stake. And I mean, I'm fine. We went to first aid. It was basically like that. Like, you know, what day of the week is it? You know, who's the president of the United States? You're good. Go, you know. And I won the stake on the filly and came back and passed out in the jocks room.
Mm.
You know, so what if I had passed out at the 3/8 ball? I mean, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just, you know, just scary. A different time.
Well, let me get some, circle back to some racing issue and questions. Let me reach for the weekend and see if I've got the carryover story. I kind of touched on a little bit. I touched on a little bit yesterday. Rich, you know what I can ask you about, actually, now that I'm just looking at the charts from the weekend?
Yep.
You know, that the track that we dealt with on Sunday, you know, and I was concerned immediately after the first two, you know, sitting up in the, we were upstairs there in that seating area, which is really a nice way to spend the day, but... you know, the track had been sealed, and it was still muddy and still had plenty of moisture to start the day. And you know, you had to be close. I kind of put us in a quandary, frankly, going into that third race with Scherzando, where you know he's kind of a one run closer, sprint closing sprinter. And so we talked to Cancel and said, you know, Gary says, what do you think here? Is always his introduction. And you let the, you know, and he responds. He said, I think got to be a little closer and, you know, don't want to leave him with too much to do on the way the track is. And what you know, for you and for your experience, because one of our partners, Marty Shapiro, I thought brought up a good point after the race with me. He said, you know, sometimes you're better off not going against a horse's nature and just go ahead and, you know, let him run his race, because it was obvious afterward that he doesn't want to be that close. He's a horse that, you know, it would rather settle and come with the one run. So, but what's your treatise on you know, adjusting to a track and trying to take a horse maybe out of his comfort zone and out of his, you know, aptitude, as it were, and trying to play to the way the track is?
Well, I think in general, and I'll cite an exception, but I think in general it's a bad idea. I think that when you take a horse out of their comfort zone and force them to do something that is against their general nature, they use more energy up that way. Now, in the case of Shazando the other day, even if you're trying to play the track a bit, once he broke a step slow, now it even dictates more that you just have to play the hand you're dealt and say, okay, this happened. Let me just take my time, come with a run. You know, he's probably not going to win. I certainly easily could see him second. You know, the winner was good, and the winner naturally played into the strength of the track. But you should have been second. And, you know, it's something I think about a lot. There are jockeys and there are race riders. And there's a lot of competent jockeys. But a race rider is a different level. A race rider is a guy that's whole life is dedicated to it. It's not a job. It's a way of life. It's not a career. It's the way they do everything. It's the way they eat, the way they sleep, the way they conduct themselves, their preparation, and their thought process. And, you know, I talked about this years ago when I was teaching the apprentice program with, like, IRAD. And anybody can be a jockey. Well, you know, not anybody, but, you know, there are a lot of jockeys. You get a license, you're a jockey, right? But it's like the difference between bacon and eggs. The chicken's involved. The pig's committed. If you're a race rider, you're committed. You're committed to the craft. You're consumed with continually improving, and you're always dissatisfied to some extent. You know, if you were fourth and you should have been second, that eats at you because you're a race rider. You're committed to the craft. And I just don't see as much of that. And maybe it has to do with, and I'm not calling out anybody in you know, specifically, I'm talking in general terms here. I don't know if it's because of the purse structure and how much money guys are making. Well, there'll be another one. But there's not always another one for an ownership group. You know, a trainer that, you know, needs that win, or a groom that's getting up 5 o'clock every morning and working with these horses. Like, your level of commitment has to be so much to all of these factions, to the people wagering on it, to the owner, the breeder. You know, that breeder might have owned the mare, and if the mare throws a winner, the sale that's coming up now, they, you know, the mare is the producer, and it's going to help. Sure. Pay his bills. Like, there's so many levels of this that if you're a race rider, you have to recognize and understand your responsibility that goes so far deeper than that one race, that immediate moment, that it touches so many other lives. And I just wish I saw that level of commitment on a more consistent basis to, again, the only way I can put it, it's a craft. It's you have a privilege to do something, and you also have a job that an ambulance follows you around. Don't you owe it, obviously, to yourself to be the best you can be? Because you never know when it's going to end. There's going to be a last day. You know, and the people that are putting so much work in behind the scenes, I mean, you know, listen, I lived in the barn. I rode over on the horse van, the aqueduct, on freezing cold days and cooled horses out and, you know, was a part of the process. And, you know, the grooms were my best friends. And, I, you know, those people were my family. And I saw the amount of work that goes in. You can't be flippant about what you're doing. Yes, you can make mistakes, but, man, make it a thought-out mistake. Make it like where you at least there was reasoning behind the mistake. That's where accountability comes in, and I wish that I saw more seriousness about that. That guy's really, really said, man, you know what? Like, I'm in a position. Now, listen, jockeys get way too much criticism when they lose and way too much credit when they win. It's such a process, and it's such a, you know, you got to be part of a team. But embrace it like you're part of a team. You're not any more important than any one cog in the wheel. You know, you have to. You're the high profile one. You're out in the front of the house. But man, make it count. Don't like it's never acceptable to say, well, I'll get them next time. There's another time. No, how many horses get injured in between this race and the next one?
Well, exactly.
Don't get
exactly
to the next one.
No, precisely, and that eats at you too. You know, having to sweat out the, you know, whatever, the 4 weeks between, you know, between starts, and to be honest, I mean, that's sort of what went on here, leading into this start. After, you know, Gary was not happy. He thought that last start at Belmont actually was. Was ready to win there. So anyway, we'll look to.
You next can't
month.
Move any stone unturned, Steve.
No.
You can't.
No,
you can't. It's too important. There's too much on the line for every stakeholder in this, and that's what's unique about racing: the variety of stakeholders. From, you know, again, going back to the breeder and the farm manager and the people that work on the farm and the veterinarians that fold the foals and the night watchman who's on foal watch to, you know, the people that are wagering on it. They have a vested stake in the game. You have to, you have an immense responsibility. And again, that doesn't mean you're not going to make mistakes, and it doesn't mean you're immune from it and that mistakes aren't forgivable, but you need to be able to control all the things you possibly can control and at least constantly put your best foot forward. And not, I'm going to tell you, I see some of these kids show up in the jock's room. Again, I'm not going to call anybody's name out. They're not eating properly. You know, just because they're small in stature, they don't feel like they have to treat their bodies like an athlete. It's unacceptable to show up in a jock's room drinking a milkshake or eating a cheeseburger. You got to eat like your body is a temple, and I said this when I taught the apprentice program. You have to look at food different than the rest of the world. Everything you ingest, everything you put in your mouth, there has to be a reason for putting it in your mouth. What is it going to do for me? What kind of energy is it going to give me? What kind of clarity is it going to give me? Not because it tastes good, but because it's going to make you the best athlete you can be. You're an athlete. You have to treat yourself as such. And it frustrates me. I mean, listen, I was a guy who had to work hard on my weight regardless. I mean, I was not jockey size. But if you are jockey size, you know, a guy that naturally is 105 pounds, 110 pounds, now you know how great you can be, because you can really fuel up, put the right things in, put the nutrition that's necessary to ride 9-10 races a day and ride every one with the same enthusiasm, same clarity, same strength. And that's the one thing that would show up on me was clarity at times, because I just didn't have enough calories to consistently
right.
see it as the way I wanted to see it. And then attitude, you know, you starve, live on 700 calories a day and tell me how snappy you get. I mean,
yeah,
you
exactly.
want to talk about hangry.
But
if you can ingest 1500 calories a day, make them the best 1500 calories, make yourself a mean, lean fighting machine, you know?
we've talked about between you and Tony, we've certainly over the years have talked about, you know, who there is for guidance on this topic, whether it's something formal from the racetrack or whether it's informal and guys, you know, seeking out mentors, for instance. I mean, and you really do get the sense that, you know, especially in light of the Ortiz suspension, that there isn't enough of this going on, Rich. I mean, to be honest, that right now, I mean, that some of that formality is of a process, including, you know, you created that program, that the apprentice, the jockey mentorship, and you know, where else is that, you know, is that not being done enough, essentially? I mean, and why isn't it being continued?
It goes deeper, though, Steve. Though it genuinely does go deeper. Like, and you know, again, the way the racetrack was when I first came around, and I don't know if it ever can get quite back to that. But the level of horsemanship on every level, you know, the grooms and the exercise riders, and I was fortunate, again, coming up under contract, Steve, tomorrow, we had a core group of people. Now, Kenny Hargraves, who trains horses now in Louisiana, and who I owe a phone call to, by the way, I got to give him a call, he had ridden. And he was one of the assistants, and he galloped, and he would show me things. And the first races I rode in his saddle. I didn't have enough money to buy a racing saddle yet. I was just starting. I was making $90 a week, and I rode in his tack, and him explaining how different it is, you know, and then putting it on one in the morning, and wow, this little saddle, and it's slippery, it's not like having an actual saddle, and the day watch lady that worked for us, you know, telling me to go buy socks and underwear, and her embroidering my name into all of them because they're going to get thrown in a community laundry barrel. Like, they already knew the ropes, so even before I walked in the room, I had been explained how things work. And so the mentorship started from these tremendous horse people already that you worked with on a daily basis. And then when you got in the room, you know, you had guys like, you know, Eddie Maple, Mike Venezia, Georgie Velasquez, who were going to, you know, hey, kid, not like that, you know, and you would snap too. I mean, I remember Eddie Maple getting so mad at me one day. I came out over heels. I put him in a real bad spot. I was young. Man, he reamed me out. Next day, I was afraid to come to the room. I was like, you know, tiptoeing around. And then he treated me like nothing happened. And you learn, okay, I made a mistake. He got the message through. You know, he doesn't hate me, you know. It just, like, on so many levels. And also the process just to get licensed as a jockey. I don't know exactly what the protocol is now, but I'm certain it's not as stringent as it was. Okay. I'm going to ride. I got to spend 2 weeks with the patrol judges. Every day, every racing day, I'm in the car at the half-mile pole in the patrol judges' stand. I'm at the 5/8 pole. I'm at the quarter pole. For 2 weeks, every day, I'm at a different juncture with the patrol judges. Now, they're not up in those stands anymore, but doesn't mean they're not watching, you know, because the films and everything. Then a week, every single day, at the starting gate. With the starter and understanding, you know, what's expected of the riders in the gate, how they're doing things, what they're doing. Then the outriders got to vouch for you. Say, you know, I've been watching this kid gallop. He's okay. Two riders in good standing with the Jockeys Guild had to step up, journeyman, and say, no, that kid's all right. I worked horses with him. Then you got to ride two races and without a whip, two races. And then after the second race, they would call you in and say, okay, we think you're ready. We're going to give you your license. Or, you know what, you need more time. You know, go back to the farm or gallop horses for another 3 months, 6 months, whatever it is. I was so proud that I rode one race and the stewards called me in and said, you're good to go, and they gave me my license. You know, so it was like a whole process of how you got that license. Now it feels like, oh, you're 110 pounds. The guy named John Horse. Here you go. I mean, I say this all the time. Listen, I can drive a car. I can drive on the Belt Parkway. That does not make me qualified to drive in the Indy 500.
No. Well put and well framed. I'm glad this came up. I before we go, too, I want to slip in one compliment. People may have seen me tweet it just sitting watching the racing. I don't know if you saw in the opener on Sunday, Rich, the 10-pound bug, Ailsa Morrison. Did you see what happened with her horse, that horse of Falcone's, that she came out and the filly kind of got edgy and almost backed straight into the rail. I thought she was going to go over, and Morrison jumped down, but then got back on and, you know, got her focused, and then rode a terrific race to just get beat and lose the photo. But I thought to myself, she's going to be shy on this horse, and in fact she did a great job getting that horse's head in the game and then almost winning.
Well, you want to talk about somebody that I've seen around over time and galloping horses, and I believe she was galloping for Mott for a while. She has a great foundation. She's not just a kid out
equestrian.
There, like stunt, right?
Yeah, equestrian. She came out of New Brunswick and did a lot of equestrian riding.
Yeah, so they have a foundation in riding. I hate to sound like I'm on a soapbox here, but I knew how to ride horses long before I knew how to ride racehorses. I knew how to, it's a different thing. You have to have that foundation to be able to actually ride, and then it develops into the skill set of being able to ride racehorses, ride races. But the foundation is in the riding. You know, it's like what Carmella says, dressage is to riding what, I'm going to lose it now. How does she say it? To language. What's the language that all languages come from?
Latin.
Latin is what Latin is to language. Dressage is to riding.
Gotcha.
It's the foundation. It's where everything else will stem from, because you learn to use your seat, to use your hands, to really meld with a horse. And then these other disciplines stem from that. And race riding or riding racehorses, because of the shorter stirrups and different, ways of doing it, is just another discipline. It's just another way to approach it. And for the people out there that why do they have to ride with such short stirrups? A lot more horses will get injured if people start riding with longer stirrups, because you can't control your weight as well, and your weight shifts around too much. So, for anybody that thinks, that's not right, you know what? It's right for the horses, on top of the fact that it's aerodynamic. And as a 115-pound person, you need some leverage at times to control a 1,000-pound animal that is very, very strong. And with your stirrups long and sitting into a seat, you do not have that same leverage. And then throw into it, like I said, you can't control your legs as much when you have 18 inches of stirrup webbings as opposed to 7. But anyway, that's me. That's my soapbox. But
that's all right. No, I wanted to slip that in since we were talking, learning, and she's just only ridden a dozen races in New York thus far, and she's got 4 seconds. She's looking for a breakthrough win, and boy, it could have easily come in that opener on Sunday. Just got nipped. I was impressed.
Right attitude too. She's got the right attitude. She's got the enthusiasm, and she has the foundation. That's the recipe for success there.
It is. Speaking of recipes, Rich probably planning dinner tonight. And with Rich, I appreciate it. We're going to talk to Daryl Viena next and Art Sherman in this next hour.
Two fine gentlemen. Tell them I said hello. Take care.
There you go. Rich Migliori, everybody. And you can follow Rich again on Twitter. He's back. And if you haven't had the chance to get back with Mig and follow him, he's back in the swing of things. Mig 4450 is the address this time around. He jumped on the chance to have just Mig, M-I-G. So Mig 4450. We'll take a break, top of the hour here. And as I mentioned, Daryl Viena is going to join us, pay tribute to Gilded Time. And when the news came Friday that he had passed a week earlier in Alberta, there was a big response. People, a lot of people that seemed to have latched on to him when he won the Juvenile, and kind of one of those horses that people thought of as you know, one of their entree horses to the game, which I thought was nice. I just remember him winning the juvenile. We'll talk to Daryl, who we haven't spoken to in too long. Daryl Vienna next, hour three.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development.